This podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and does not constitute formal medical advice, clinical guidance, or institutional policy. The views expressed are those of the hosts and guests and may not reflect those of any official policies or affiliated organizations. Always verify information, consult appropriate resources, and apply your own clinical judgment before caring for patients. Welcome to Gray Matters, where we unpack how medical management is rarely black or white.
And go on deep dives along the way.
I'm Dr. Nick Filano.
I'm Dr. Sherry Chivetti. And on our last episode on orthostatic hypotension, Nick brought a really interesting case to the Gray Matters table. It was a 72-year-old male whose hospital course was complicated by orthostatic hypotension. And we figured out it wasn't dehydration or some other easily reversible cause. We reviewed some meds. We stopped some isocerebide mononitrate.
Yep. I also gave him an abdominal binder. I told him to eat more, smaller meals throughout the day instead of just a few big ones. And I even taught him this cool drink water really quickly trick that we talked about last episode, if you missed that. And physical therapy taught him some in-bed exercises to keep up his strength.
Yes. Nick, I really want to believe that chugging cold water really fast in the morning did the trick and he's all cured and ready for discharge.
Same here. I would have felt so cool if that worked. It did help, but unfortunately it didn't fix all his problems. His standing blood pressures did improve, but you know, they were still in the high 80s systolic when standing. And his symptoms decreased, but they were still not totally tolerable for him. And physical therapy thought that he could use a little extra help.
Man, I feel like you've really done your due diligence here. And I think you tried so hard to avoid new medicines for the 72-year-old gentleman. And I think sounds like we're at the point, though.
Right. I mean, orthostatic hypotension was already an unintended consequence of this admission. The last thing I wanted to do was start a medication that could also have unintended consequences. You know, it just felt risky. So ultimately, that led me down a deep dive on what really are the best practices on when and how to start medications for orthostatic hypotension in a hospitalized patient.
So there's a lot of CME courses around, but how much of it is truly clinically valuable and free of commercial influence? That's what makes Oakstone CME stand out, whether you're listening to ACP MixApp Audio Companion or diving into their board prep content. Everything is expert-led, evidence-based, no ads, no fluff. Their content's developed in collaboration with leading medical institutions, and it shows. The material is sharp, practical, packed with clinical pearls that you can use right away. I've walked into episodes for sure and been able to apply things that very same week. And there's something for everyone, over 30 specialties to choose from with case-based reviews and real-world relevance to build in. So if you're looking for a trusted, no BS CME that actually helps your practice, check out oakstone.com/mixapp. That's oakstone/MKSAP. Use the code CORE25 for 25% off. And this is exclusive to Corium listeners. So don't forget to use the code CORE25. And with that, let's get back into the episode.
So I know I was trying to avoid these medications, but if you think about it, if someone's orthostatic hypotension is causing, you know, significant functional impairment or falls, I mean, maybe the bar to start these medications should actually be pretty low instead of pretty high.
A lot of the time, that's when I'm going to reach out to the medical team going, look, we've tried this. It's starting to limit their ability to participate maximally in PT. And, you know, a lot of the time when I'm saying, is there anything else you can do? I mean, is there any medication? Because I can't do that. That seems like a reasonable actual teamwork to decide what's best for the patient.
So you've got to be creative and you've got to get them moving. You've got to get them. Our therapy colleagues are critical to that goal. The worst thing is to say, oh, we're not going to do therapy for another 3 days because they're still orthostatic.
Yeah, I think I can soothe my anxiety over starting new medications by looking at more as a bridge to allow my patient to start to move, you know, something that can be weaned off in the future rather than a new long-term permanent medication. That definitely helps.
Yeah. I like that framing too. And speaking of framing, when I think about orthostatic hypotension meds, my framework's pretty much like Minadrin, maybe fludrocortisone. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. That was mine too. So, you know, of course, I figure I need to get it moving. I'll start Minadrin, you know, start with the classic.
First, Minadrin is an alpha agonist, causes vasoconstriction and raises the floor of your pressure. So if your pressure is fluctuating between 110 and 80, it may raise it up. So now it fluctuates between 140 and 100 or something like that.
So I did start Minadrin and it worked. You know, his standing systolic blood pressure, I said it was in the 80s. And with that, it went to the hundreds.
Yay, win.
Yeah, that was great. But unfortunately, that wasn't the only thing that went up. His supine blood pressure also started to rise, aka supine hypertension. That went all the way to the 180s. And that's when I remembered that Midodrine actually has a black box warning for severe supine hypertension.
Ugh, that pesky black box warning. I feel like I always forget about supine hypertension until I get a page about it.
Yeah, I know. And on Midodrine's label, it actually cites a study where after just 10 milligrams of Midodrine, 13% of people had a supine systolic blood pressure over 200. So, you know, maybe avoid Midodrine in that patient who already has pretty significant resting hypertension. And for everyone else, just really try to avoid it if they're not going to be moving and if they don't actually need the Midodrine at that time.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I feel like so many people's practice is just to start the Midodrine TID standing and then walk away.
So a patient has hypertension, I usually treat in the morning. And, you know, the noon dose or the afternoon dose, that depends on the patient's activity. I treat in the morning because they are very active in the morning. They are less active throughout the day.
So I guess one way to do it is time that Midodrine in the morning when the patient is more active, might be getting up and doing exercises, and then hold off on the times when they're lying down and less active.
Yeah, and since this medication needs careful titration, you know, you don't want to be too high or low, Dr. Chabau says that we should actually check orthostatic vital signs about an hour after giving Midodrine. That way you can test to make sure it's working and get a sense of whether you need to bring the dose up or down.
So Midodrine kicks in 60 minutes and it goes away in 3 or 4 hours. So you need to gather some information, some objective data that there is some response in the blood pressure. And of course, maybe some response in symptoms.
Yeah, I think it's good to know that the Midodrine works in about 16 minutes. And so we can get quick feedback on the Midodrine in terms of both effectiveness as well as side effects like supine hypertension.
Yeah, definitely. So instead of just, you know, starting a TID and walking away, I timed the Midodrine for the mornings and then before my patient worked with physical therapy. But I held off giving in the evenings since he really didn't move around that much at that time. With that, his supine blood pressure got better. We tested his blood pressure with physical therapy to feel confident that we had the right Midodrine dose for him. Everything seemed like it was going great until his urinary retention started to worsen again.
Wait, why did his urinary retention come back? Was it because of the Midodrine?
Yeah. Remember, Midodrine is an alpha agonist, so urinary retention is one of the side effects. You know, we had taken the Foley catheter out, he had passed a trial avoid, but then with the Midodrine, it started to get worse again. And, you know, I kind of felt like now I have to back down and think of something else to add.
Yeah. I mean, when people don't respond to Midodrine or we can't go up higher on the dose of that Midodrine without side effects like supine hypertension or that urinary retention, I feel like the next thing is fludrocortisone, but I don't know if that's the right move or not.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's always what I was taught too. And fludrocortisone can be effective. We usually use doses that are a little bit lower, like 0.1 or 0.3 milligrams for orthostatic hypotension. You know, lower doses where you avoid a lot of the glucocorticoid effect. And at those doses, fludrocortisone can have a bit of a pressor effect, and it can also cause some volume retention, both of which can help with orthostatic hypotension, but both of which can also spike your blood pressure, can cause volume overload, and really importantly, can actually cause hypokalemia.
The problem with fludrocortisone is it causes hypokalemia. And I've had patients actually have VTAC from hypokalemia while on fludrocortisone, where I failed to measure the potassium soon enough.
So we published some time ago a study. The patient that received Florinef tend to have an increased number of hospitalizations compared to the patient with Midodrine. Now, it's not a perfect study, but for me, it tells me that if I have a patient with orthostatic hypotension, I will probably start Midodrine. And then I will leave the fludrocortisone for these patients that have baseline hypotension.
Oh, wow. So takeaway is to pick the patient we start fludrocortisone pretty carefully. We want to watch our potassium because that fludrocortisone at low doses has more of a mineralocorticoid effect and volume retention. So we want to avoid fludrocortisone in patients with high blood pressure or heart failure.
Yeah, definitely. And my patient already had some high blood pressure, more on that later, and did have a little bit of pedal edema. So I just thought maybe this isn't the best patient to start fludrocortisone on.
Yeah. So what did you do for your patient who wasn't responding as much to the Midodrine dose you wanted and wasn't a great candidate for fludrocortisone because of his blood pressure?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, this is kind of an uncomfortable spot for me because I wasn't really sure where to go from here. I mean, my Midodrine fludrocortisone pathway had pretty much exhausted.
Yeah, and then on top of it, and I think in the prior episode, you said you were concerned about autonomic neuropathy. As a throwback to episode one, you know, we talked about the heart rate didn't go up as we'd expect, especially that delta of the heart rate change on standing over the delta of the blood pressure change on standing was not over 0.5.
Yeah, definitely. And since we're worried about this patient having some kind of autonomic disease, I leaned on our autonomic specialist, Dr. Chabal, about where we should go from here in starting new medications.
Droxidopa is a new drug in the United States, but it's not a new drug in the rest of the world. So in Japan, it has been used for years to treat orthostatic hypotension.
Droxidopa. Wow, I really didn't know much about this before you had said this.
Yeah, it was a new one for me too. I mean, droxidopa is really meant for those with severe autonomic disease since it's basically turning into norepinephrine in the body. Droxidopa and midodrine are actually the only two FDA-approved meds for treating neurogenic orthostatic hypotension, and they also share the same black box warning for supine hypertension.
Droxidopa has been associated with less supine hypertension compared to midodrine in some of the post-marketing studies.
Nice. So droxidopa has less supine hypertension than midodrine. Any other side effects of droxidopa other than the supine hypertension?
Yeah, there are some neurogenic side effects to watch out for. At higher doses, it can produce hallucinations or confusion. But luckily, those symptoms do go away if you lower the dose or stop the medication altogether.
Yeah, and then I'm guessing with a new med like droxidopa, it's really the issue is going to be cost and access, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not available everywhere, but thankfully it is improving. Dr. Chabal told me that she really reaches for this medication in patients with autonomic failure when midodrine isn't enough, and there's a reason to avoid fludrocortisone, like heart failure.
So far, we talked through midodrine, fludrocortisone, and droxidopa. What else do we have in our toolkit for orthostatic hypotension?
Pyridostigmine is a cholinesterase inhibitor that increases acetylcholine activity and, in my experience, causes lots of GI side effects.
So pyridostigmine can be helpful because it increases both sympathetic and parasympathetic activity, which means it's less likely to worsen hypertension, but it can cause GI issues. So, you know, no free lunch here.
Other drugs that can be used, though, that are much more common are NSAIDs. I mean, NSAIDs, the reason we don't like NSAIDs is they cause hypertension and edema, not to mention their GI side effects. But you could give an NSAID with a PPI and get away with it. And that can sometimes raise pressure.
Wow. Good old NSAID popping up to be helpful. So what did you end up doing for your patient?
So I ended up trying the pyridostigmine as well as the lower dose of midodrine. And with that, he was able to tolerate it. Physical therapy was pretty happy with his progress. And I didn't get too much supine hypertension or GI side effects. So I was happy too.
That is a win. Awesome. So let's simplify all this awesome teaching on orthostatic hypotension meds. So it sounds like in terms of starting the medicine, as guilty as we feel about it and doing it, it's really when our patients' ADLs are affected or it's causing falls that we should be reaching for it. We want to help them control their symptoms, but more importantly, get them moving and not worsening any orthostatic hypotension.
Definitely. The more they don't move, the more that orthostatic hypotension is going to get worse. And specifically for neurogenic orthostatic hypotension, midodrine and droxidopa have the most evidence, but they also can both cause severe supine hypertension. So to avoid worsening hypertension, make sure that you time midodrine with activity and avoid giving it if the patient's just going to be resting. Midodrine can contribute to urinary retention, and droxidopa can cause hallucinations or confusion, and it might just be less available and harder to find overall.
Exactly. And then there's also our other three options. One is fludrocortisone, but we're going to try to avoid it in people who already have high blood pressures or heart failure, and we're going to monitor that potassium really closely. There's also pyridostigmine, which causes less hypertension, but does have some GI side effects. And then surprise to learn about NSAIDs, which can also help in orthostatic hypotension, but it's really if your patient can tolerate that NSAID from a GI perspective as well as the kidney perspective.
So I was really happy to see that this patient did well on this new medication regimen. But, you know, like I said at the beginning of episode one, I've seen a lot of patients with orthostatic hypotension. And, you know, for a lot of them, they also come in with hypertension. And that can come in so many different scenarios that it just got me thinking that it feels like we're always balancing hypertension and orthostatic hypotension. And that feels like such a hard thing to manage.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people just label this as labile blood pressures. And I don't know if we all have a good approach.
Yeah, it can be really hard. And as I was researching this episode, I went down a few rabbit holes and I was really kind of fascinated to learn the connection between hypertension and orthostatic hypotension. It really is like, how do you treat one without worsening the other? So that brought me to our next deep dive, the management of hypertension in patients with orthostatic hypotension. So let's make things a little bit more clear. The careful dance between hypertension and orthostatic hypotension can really be grouped into three big scenarios. The first is a patient with chronic hypertension and an asymptomatic drop in blood pressure when they stand up. The second is a patient with chronic hypertension, kind of similar, who actually gets true symptomatic orthostatic hypotension. And the third is a patient that really kind of keeps me up at night. It's the patient with really severe dysautonomia. These are patients with orthostatic hypotension when they stand up. Maybe their blood pressure isn't too bad when they're sitting, but they get severe hypertension when they're laying down.
So with the first group, right, this is the patient who doesn't have any symptoms. And I think I've had a lot of them where they have, you know, high blood pressures and we're trying to figure out why they fell. And sure, we do orthostatics on them and their systolic blood pressure drops from, you know, lying down, it's 160 milligrams per mercury and then just goes down to 140, no symptoms. So technically, there's a delta of 20 milligrams per mercury and that meets the criteria of orthostatic hypotension, but they're not hypotensive. So like, what do we call that?
Yeah. I mean, you're kind of getting to why it's tricky. Like, as we said in the first episode, as your blood pressure goes up, the measurement error for blood pressure also goes up. So when do we call it orthostatic hypotension? There's kind of some controversy, and there's basically two schools of thought on what cutoff we should use for the drop in systolic blood pressure to diagnose orthostatic hypotension in hypertensive patients. Some say that we should use a drop of 30 to increase specificity, you know, since things are more variable at these high blood pressures. But others say that we should just stick to 20, just like we do with every other patient, since there is evidence that this cutoff is still better at predicting orthostatic symptoms and falls, even in hypertensive patients.
So you're saying that 140 might be too low for someone who's been living at 160. So basically, this person does have orthostatic hypotension without actually having hypotension?
Yeah, it kind of boggles my mind too, but if you think about it, it's all about cerebral autoregulation. I mean, this patient's living at a blood pressure of 160 systolic most of the time, so their brain is used to dealing with a blood pressure of 160 systolic most of the time. So if they stand up and their blood pressure drops by 20 points systolic, that might be too low for their brain to handle, for what their cerebral vessels have adapted to. It's basically like functional hypotension.
Wow, wait. So what do you do with this functional hypotension? You have a patient whose systolic blood pressure dropped from 160 to 140, but they feel fine. Like, I'm not going to start some midodrine on this guy just because of the diagnosis of orthostatic hypotension or functional orthostatic hypotension.
Oh, same. I mean, remember, this person's still hypertensive. I'm definitely not rushing to start medications. All I'm saying is that the fact that they dropped is important. You know, that's notable. It's a risk factor for falls and badness in the future. So what I'm saying is that even if your patient's hypertensive, pay attention to what their blood pressure does when they stand up. Really try to make sure that you're not missing any symptoms they might be having and see if at any point they may need any kind of intervention.
So the patient who's asymptomatic but has that drop in their blood pressure, this is going to be someone who we risk stratify a little bit differently. This is somebody who we know is at risk in the future for falls. And so we're going to be advocating for regular exercise, behavioral things like having them stand up slowly, avoiding heat, smaller carb meals, things like that.
Right. Like treat the hypertension.
Wait, what? Treat the hypertension? I wouldn't be excited about that either, right? I mean, their standing blood pressure falls when they stand, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I definitely get that. I mean, hypertension and orthostatic hypotension kind of feel like opposites, kind of instinctively. Like if you treat one, the other is probably going to get worse.
Yeah, but Nick, if we do start antihypertensives, like we all know that also can increase their orthostatic hypotension, right? Like falls, that 24 hours after any med change is a risky period for falls.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. When you first start an antihypertensive, there is a risk of falls and you have to do so very carefully. But when I was doing research, I was really surprised to learn that for patients who are hypertensive and who have asymptomatic orthostatic hypotension, over the long term, starting antihypertensives didn't tend to worsen orthostasis. And in fact, in some studies, orthostasis actually improved.
Wow, that feels so counterintuitive.
Yeah, it really does feel counterintuitive. But just think about how often we see these two issues in the same patient. I mean, that's because they can really be two sides of the same disease process.
People who have hypertension are at higher risk of orthostatic hypotension. I often say the higher you are, the farther you fall. People with hypertension have impairment in their baroreflex function. In other words, they can't increase their heart rate to the same extent when they stand up. They have stiff hearts. They have vascular stiffness and inability to vasodilate and vasoconstrict to the extent you need to. And they have impairments in cerebral autoregulation. Aging does that too.
So our older patients who are hypertensive kind of have a double whammy here. They have the effects of hypertension as well as aging that will just impair their blood pressure regulatory mechanisms.
So either way, the big takeaway from scenario one is that chronic hypertension increases the risk of developing and worsening orthostatic hypotension over time. So treating the hypertension carefully can lower that risk over time.
So that's all kind of in an asymptomatic patient. Let's go to scenario two. You have somebody who has symptoms of orthostatic hypotension and has this drop in their blood pressure. I imagine we're going to be much more careful because they're symptomatic.
Yeah, definitely. This is someone you have to be very careful with. But I also want to point out that there's probably going to be this temptation to just stop all of their antihypertensive medications because they're symptomatic. Just remember that we can try to focus on the high-risk medications first, you know, beta and alpha blockers, loop diuretics, nitrates, but see if you can still continue safer ones like ACEs or ARBs, at least to start, just to avoid worsening that hypertension even further. That's why I continue lisinopril for my patient. Another thing to remember is to avoid behavioral changes that could worsen hypertension. That's things like adding extra salt in your diet, adding too much compression when a patient isn't moving, or using medications that can increase blood pressure, like midodrine or droxidopa.
And then, I mean, for this patient, you may want to, you know, increase the blood pressure above the threshold where they start having symptoms. And that threshold could be 110, 120. You try to increase as much as possible to avoid, but you have to avoid, you know, pushing the hypertension too much. So it is a very difficult patient, the one that have both.
Yeah, it's such a fine balance between improving those orthostatic symptoms without pushing the blood pressure too much and worsening the hypertension.
Yeah, that's definitely the name of the game for scenario two. But let's get into the third scenario, patients who have really severe autonomic disease and therefore really labile blood pressures.
Yeah, these are people, the autonomic disease population tend to have like pretty high blood pressure. Their systolic blood pressures can get over 200 when they're lying flat. So really bad supine hypertension.
Exactly. These patients with autonomic disease often go low when they stand up. They're like maybe in the middle with their blood pressure when they're sitting, but their blood pressure goes very high when they're laying down. That's when their sympathetic nervous system basically just isn't getting the signal to take it easy and just keeps firing. So that's what leads to these big swings in blood pressure depending on position.
Yeah, these are the patients you were talking about with our deep dive on medications where you're like, I want neuro to help and they probably need multiple medications.
Another key thing is that being supine, as we said, can make the blood pressure worse. So it's really important in this population to try to keep them moving as much as is safe.
You know, the way to treat their hypertension is don't let them be supine. So we tell them to sleep in a chair, in a recliner, or put a couple of pillows or a wedge under their bed to raise the head of the bed and their head at night. And that prevents some of the hypertension.
So this is really interesting because empirically, it seems like Dr. Lipsitz has seen results from a few pillows. But when I looked into it, a lot of the papers were suggesting more elevation. Like one study found that you need 20 to 30 centimeters of elevation to be helpful. That can be easier in a hospital bed, but can be pretty uncomfortable or risky to do at home, given the risk of sliding off. So how to apply this recommendation can be a bit gray.
Yeah, and then a bit of a throwback to our first episode when we talked about the dive on non-pharmacological treatment. We can make sure our patients are only using abdominal binders or compression stockings only when they're sitting up, moving around, and not when they're just laying there.
Yeah, using it when they're laying down can worsen supine hypertension, but could also make you, you know, see a patient say, I'm too uncomfortable with this abdominal binder, and then you write in your note, patient couldn't tolerate it. I mean, when in reality, it's really just meant for when they're moving.
But yeah, it's like, why are they wearing the abdominal binder or compression stockings while they're lying there watching Family Feud?
The other particular thing to know about these patients with autonomic dysfunction is that they can also get something called nocturnal hypertension.
Wait, Nick, what's the difference between nocturnal hypertension and supine hypertension?
So with supine hypertension, your blood pressure goes high when you lay flat. For most people, your blood pressure goes down as you sleep. And for a lot of patients with supine hypertension, this still happens. But some people have such bad supine hypertension that it stays high throughout the night, and they call that nocturnal hypertension.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's the significance of, you know, seeing nocturnal hypertension where the blood pressure is elevated all night, no matter like what position they're in, compared to supine hypertension where it's just like positioning for when they're laying down regardless of the time of the day?
So the problem with nocturnal hypertension is that it can cause something called pressure naturesis, which is basically a loss of salt and fluids while lying down due to high blood pressure.
Older folks tend to lose a lot of fluid overnight. And they lie down, fluid reaccumulates from their legs back into their central circulation, and they excrete it. They have less renin and angiotensin to hold on to it, so they excrete more salt. So by morning, many of our older patients are already dehydrated.
So learning about pressure naturesis was really fascinating. I mean, some studies said that you could lose 1 to 1.5 liters of fluid overnight if you have nocturnal hypertension.
Wow, that is a lot of fluid. So I guess our older folks at nighttime are really at risk for dehydration and fall risk, right? That nocturnal hypertension and dysautonomy can actually worsen orthostatic hypotension because of this pressure naturesis, which can lead to dehydration.
Yeah, unfortunately, treating these patients with persistent nocturnal hypertension that stays high all night, you know, it's really a gray zone. I mean, a lot of the approaches are based on physiology, but they just don't have a ton of evidence behind them. Some advocate going back to that strategy of keeping the head of the bed raised at night, although I do see a lot of warnings to pick these patients carefully, given that doing this does come at the risk of them falling out of bed or even causing ankle edema. Some providers even suggest using short-acting antihypertensives overnight. That circulation article mentions that as well. I thought this was such an interesting idea, and, you know, it does make some physiologic sense. They do bring down nocturnal blood pressure, but there really isn't great evidence that they improve morning orthostatic hypotension. And, you know, of course, there's risks there. I mean, if a patient's getting up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, I worry about falls. I mean, I'm really glad that I'm aware of how different people approach this problem differently. But personally, I'm waiting for more data before I try something like overnight antihypertensives.
Awesome. All right. This has been such an eye-opener for me. So let's summarize some of the, you know, concrete takeaways. Say you have a patient who has chronic hypertension, an asymptomatic drop in their blood pressure to be functional orthostatic hypotension. These people are going to be at risk for falls in the future. And we can think about preventive measures like exercise for them and then really managing their hypertension. And then we want to really carefully treat their hypertension because as counterintuitive as it seems, treating their hypertension will actually help their orthostatic hypotension long term.
Right. And for patients with elevated blood pressure, the second group are those who have true symptomatic orthostatic hypotension. Basically, we need to treat the orthostatic hypotension without making the hypertension worse. As for their hypertensive medication regimen, stopping high-risk medications like alpha and beta blockers can be helpful, but see if medications like ACEs and ARBs can be continued to avoid worsening the hypertension, although in some patients, they may still need to be stopped. Avoid compression stockings or binders if patients aren't moving, and be super careful with the timing of medications like Minadren.
And then for the patients with dysautonomia, they can have really bad supine hypertension, which is more of a positional thing when they lie down. And then these patients are also at risk of nocturnal hypertension, which is elevated blood pressures throughout the night, which can exacerbate volume loss from pressure naturesis.
We also want to make sure we're avoiding worsening the hypertension, you know, avoid compression unless people are actually moving, no extra salt, avoiding Minadren too close to bedtime. And then finally, try to identify patients who have true nocturnal hypertension. Select patients could benefit from sleeping with the head of the bed up. And I know that I'm going to be looking for more studies in the future on the effect of overnight antihypertensives.
Here at Corium, we're talking about the real things that can help anyone who works in healthcare. And today we're talking about how the scrubs you wear, they can make a difference. I remember the first time I saw one of my colleagues walking into a sign-up room looking way more put together after a night shift. And I knew right then and there, they were wearing FIGS. FIGS scrubs is made specifically for us doctors, residents, students, healthcare professionals who are putting in long hours and really need gear that can keep up and perform on our level. We have so much going on in any shift, right? Scrubs are the last thing we want to be thinking about, and that's why FIGS is great in that they're lightweight, stretchy, breathable. They have all the small touches that have made me a true convert. They're clean, they're modern, super functional, tons of pockets that I love for all the snacks, zippers that don't snag, and antimicrobial fabric to stay healthy while working. You deserve better scrubs. You deserve FIGS. So head over to FIGS.com and enter FIGSRX at the checkout for 15% off your first purchase. That's FIGS.com, promo code FIGSRX for 15% off your first purchase. And with that, let's head back to the episode.
It can be tricky to cook meals that are fast, flavorful, and still feel special. I think one of the best shortcuts is frozen Washington red raspberries. These berries are picked at peak ripeness and frozen within hours, so locking in that bright, sweet, tart flavor that instantly levels up everything from smoothies to oatmeal, sauces, baked treats. There's no added sugars, no preservatives, just real fruit. And the best part is that they're grown by passionate family farmers in Washington State and harvested with care. They have definitely become a freezer staple in my house. I love being able to throw it in super quick, and it feels like it instantly elevates the recipe with its vibrant color, its flavor. You can find it at Costco, Kroger's, Winco Foods. You can also find Washington Red Raspberries in Kirkland's Signature 3 Berry Blend, or Smucker's Raspberry Jam, or Raspberry Uncrustables. Always check the label to see quote-unquote products of the U.S. And if you're looking for more recipe ideas or cooking tips, you can visit redraz.org. That's redraz.org. And with that, let's get back into the episode. Nick, I feel like we've covered a ton in this episode. I think there's so much I didn't know about orthostatic hypotension.
So much that your head's spinning, right?
No. I do feel like a sense of clarity, but I just want to close out your patient's story, right? You did all these wonderful things to avoid medications. You really encouraged exercises. You did abdominal compression only when he was moving. You timed his midodrine and pyridostigmine. And maybe from our last deep dive with his supine hypertension, maybe you gave some extra pillows and captopril at nighttime. So in thinking about discharge, our treatment goals initially were to raise the standing blood pressure out of the danger zone, which you did, and then minimize symptoms that were affecting his functioning. Now, this is all great, but did you minimize the symptoms enough for him to go?
Yeah, this is exactly what I was asking myself. I mean, the perfectionist in me would love for all symptoms to be gone, for the numbers to be much, much better. And he still had a little bit of lightheadedness.
Yeah. I mean, but then again, I think many people get a little dizzy when they stand up, but then they steady themselves just fine.
Yeah, it's tempting to add a new medication. That can bring on a whole string of other problems. And this seems to be pretty well controlled. Is it a concerning value? Yeah. But is he falling? No. Is he super symptomatic and it's ruining his quality of life? No. Okay, let's not maybe add all those other things and give you other problems that are, you don't want to cause more problems by trying to fix a problem that maybe isn't a problem for that person. The number's a problem. Is it a problem for the person?
Yeah, so maybe it's better just ask this person, like, hey, do you feel well enough to move, to go to the bathroom, to do what rehab will need for you to do?
Yeah, I love that. What a great question to ask patients. What did your patient say?
Yeah, honestly, when I asked him that, he said that he did feel well enough. Like, I'm very good at worrying, so I still wanted some objective input. I was like, how can I make this call with such limited information? But, Sharon did calm me down and, scrape me off the ceiling and reminded me that physical therapy actually does go into an in-depth assessment to help make the call for discharge. And knowing that we were really part of a multidisciplinary team did help me let go a little bit.
So sometimes stepping back, looking at that whole picture, where's this person going to be living? What kind of supports are they going to have? How much can they manage this problem by understanding what the worst case scenario could be? And we've got a lot of really valid different kinds of screening tools that we can use that are very functional depending on the person's status as far as, how mobile are they, how not mobile are they, that we can do really pretty quickly in the hospital if somebody is able to at least stand up and move around, where we can go, hey, and also based on this test, that's going to really say that they're at a much higher risk for falls than we would anticipate. There's a really 30-second chair stand. How many times can they stand up and sit down in 30 seconds? The timed up and go, somebody stands up, they walk about 10 feet, turn around, walk back and sit down. For most adults in the community, if it takes them longer than about 11, 12 seconds to do that, they're already at higher risk for falls.
Yeah, I think this is all a good reminder that we can just ask PT, hey, I'm worried about this guy. Do you think he's going to need some extra medications, or is he moving okay, and get their input?
Yeah, definitely. And it made me wonder, so if physical therapy has all these things they're doing to see if a patient's meeting their goal for discharge, what exactly is their goal for this patient being discharged?
I would love an absence of symptoms. Let's be clear. I want it to be resolved, but I'll tolerate a little bit of lightheadedness if I have to, as long as I can maintain their safety. Let's make sure that I make sure your balance is primed up as much as it can be. Let's make sure your strength is as good as it can be and your endurance is as good as it can be, so that if you do get a little lightheaded from this, or you forget to do all your countermeasures and slow down a little bit, that you've got that extra strength and balance and endurance to maybe make sure that you're not going to have a fall.
Yeah. So it sounds like there is no one answer to when are his symptoms better enough for discharge, but really just an ongoing conversation between you, the patient, and physical therapy.
Exactly. I mean, we need to do everything we can to lower the fall risk, but it's really hard to totally eliminate it. I mean, we can't often eliminate it. And there's a real risk for keeping this person in the hospital. I mean, if a day of immobility can affect an astronaut, it can definitely affect our patients.
And they just lie in bed for more days, they're only going to get worse. So you've got to sort of negotiate that, yes, we know there's a risk. We're going to have to take that risk. We're going to protect them at every step. We'll hold them on the arm. We'll make sure, you know, put the belt around them to hold them up if we need to. But we're going to take that risk so that we can begin to get them moving, get those leg muscles pumping.
As long as the patient, you know, is disabled and unable to do any physical activity, the more difficult it's going to be to treat him or her and prevent them being dependent on a wheelchair, which is, you know, the worst case scenario, right?
So all the more reasons to get your patients going to rehab on the sooner side. I think some key takeaways from this dive on discharging patients with orthostatic hypotension is kind of thinking through a checklist. Like, one, is that blood pressure reasonable? Two, are those symptoms improving or, more importantly, manageable for the patient? And then three, physical therapy can help confirm safety and rehab readiness in case rehab is the right next place. And of course, we need to weigh that all against the real harm of patients just lying in bed, losing muscle mass, and becoming more decongestioned and worsening their orthostatic hypotension.
But, you know, this episode helped me look at a pretty familiar problem in a new way. I've had a lot more conversations with physical therapists since talking to these experts.
Yeah, and this feels like a call to action for me to the same. And so why don't we take a second to review all the great points from the two episodes we did on orthostatic hypotension?
Definitely. So in part one, we started with our first deep dive on diagnosing orthostatic hypotension. We said that we should ensure that we have a well-sized cuff, have the patient supine for at least 5 minutes at a baseline if possible, and then look at blood pressure, heart rate, and symptoms at 1 and 3 minutes, and potentially again later if your index of suspicion is high enough. Look out for symptoms that may suggest autonomic disease, like a blunted heart rate response, any kind of neurologic symptoms, or asymptomatic falls. Your tests will probably be more sensitive in the morning or in circumstances which the patient previously fell.
Right. And then when we're treating the patient, our goal is to get the blood pressure out of a danger zone, so usually greater than a systolic blood pressure of 90 to 100. And more importantly, we want to make sure the symptoms are eliminated or at least manageable.
And in Deep Dive 3, we talked about how preventing orthostatic hypotension with early mobility is critical in the hospital. If orthostatic hypotension does develop, work with physical therapy to create a safe plan to continue exercising, even if that means in bed. Look for treatable causes of orthostatic hypotension like heart disease or dehydration. Look for triggers like just after meals or for any high-risk medications. But remember, you don't necessarily need to just stop all blood pressure medicines right away.
We can consider an abdomen binder. Fluid salt intake can help improve symptoms if it's right for the patient. And if that's not enough to reach our treatment goals, then Deep Dive 4, we talked about medication options.
Right. And we said that picking a medication regimen means we need to consider the potential side effects as well as our patient's own comorbidities. Midodrine is often used, but it's super important how you time it and dose it to try to avoid supine hypertension.
And then there's fludrocortisone, but that can lead to hypertension, hypokalemia, and edema.
We can also talk to specialists about medications like droxidopa or pyridostigmine. And speaking of hypertension, we learned in Deep Dive 5 that patients with chronic hypertension are at higher risk for orthostatic hypotension. So long-term blood pressure control can actually help. Just be sure to pick a medication that's lower risk for causing orthostatic hypotension, like an ACE or an ARB.
And then the subset of patients who have sustained overnight hypertension may be getting dehydrated overnight from pressure naturesis. So consider elevating the head above bed.
And finally, in Deep Dive 6, what I took away about discharging patients from the hospital is we need to do our best to get the blood pressure out of that danger zone, minimize symptoms, and then really talk to our physical therapy colleagues about how our patients are doing to come to a multidisciplinary decision about when that patient is ready to leave the hospital.
Yeah. And then the reason why this is all so important is because even a few days of mostly being bedbound means that the patient's going to lose muscle mass, become deconditioned, and likely worsen their orthostatic hypotension.
That's definitely true. And that is a wrap for today. If you found this episode helpful, please share with your team and colleagues and give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help people find us.
Yeah, and if you have a case you'd like to bring on the Gray Matters table, please email us at hello@coriampodcast.com. Thank you to our reviewers for this episode. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliate institutions. Thank you.
A BetterHelp ad. Lewis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
or I struggle most weeks to like get myself up and ready and go to therapy or whatever. Like even like to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Like, 'cause I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.